So let me read from Ephesians 6, verse 5. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at work for hours. So confessed the hero in Jerome K. Jerome's comic novel, Three Men in a Boat, and I suspect he speaks for a great many of us. Leisure is what really makes life worth living, isn't it? Work is at best a necessary evil, at worst a damnable curse. You only have to look at those office posters that people display to be convinced of that. Hard work never killed anyone, but why take the chance? Thank God it's Friday. Perhaps most revealing, that bumper sticker I saw some weeks ago, mimicking the song of the seven dwarves in Disney's Snow White. I-O-W-E, that is. I-O, so off to work I go. There was a fellow, clearly, who submitted to the tedium and drudgery of the office only because he had a mortgage to pay off. Perhaps that's what we really resent about work, is it? The knowledge that we have to do it. And it can't be the physical and mental exertion involved, can it? Because many of us in our free time engage in athletic and in intellectual activities far more grueling than anything our job demands of us. No, it's the compulsory nature of regular employment that irks us, isn't it? We feel we are trapped like rats on a treadmill. Every Monday morning we have to mount it again and turn the grindstone for another 5-day cycle. We've got no choice in the matter. For work isn't the voluntary engagement of our human creative energies. It's a compulsory chore. It's an inescapable fag. That's what it is. It was precisely, of course, that sense of gnawing frustration and discontent that Karl Marx identified and described so successfully in his writings in the last century. Borrowing a word from the philosopher Hegel, he called it the alienation of labor. Workers in a capitalist society, he said, were simply waged slaves. They may earn money, but they're not really any freer than a convict on a chain gang or a slave in a galley. They are prisoners of an exploitative system, he says, that steals their human liberty and dignity and turns them into mere fodder for an industrial machine. I suppose many of us would want to pour scorn on the socialist alternative. We would point to the prosperity which capitalism has brought to Western countries and the economic chaos which, by contrast, is currently afflicting just about every single society of the world which has ever embraced communism. But I'm not so sure we can dispense with the criticisms of Comrade Marx quite so easily. Because when I see those grim and resigned faces of the commuters on the London train each Monday morning, it seems to me they bear rather eloquent testimony to the truth of at least part of Marx's analysis. The vast majority of men and women in our Western society do not go to work because they enjoy it. They go to work because they must. The grim necessity of economic survival renders daily employment little less mandatory and little less oppressive to their spirit than would forced labor. The only reason they don't rise up in revolutionary indignation, as Marx predicted they would, is that they have been sufficiently bribed by material rewards to put up with it. A contemporary Marxist would say, oh, the wage laborers of Victorian Britain may have been little better than a slave, but the wage laborer of modern Britain is little better than a prostitute. For he sells the use of his body and mind to his employer for 37.5 hours per week. Why? Because it pays well, that's why. It provides him with the affluent lifestyle he's come to expect. He gets little or no satisfaction from those 37 and a half hours. Those self-interest demands that he suck up to his boss, that he at least contrive to appear to give the best to his company, all those compliant endeavors are really just because he knows which side his bread's buttered on. In private, it's not unusual to find that he despises his job, that he holds in contempt his boss, that he longs for the day when, with a suitably obscene farewell gesture, he can be rid of the lot of them. You may say I'm exaggerating. It's not like that for you, I hope it isn't. But just suppose you learned this afternoon that you'd inherited £1 million from some unknown relative in Australia. Would you be going back to work next week? I suspect most of us, if we're honest, would have to confess we would be strongly tempted to take early retirement, wouldn't we? Just think of it, no more hassle, no more stress, no more routine, and most of all, no more Mondays. Wouldn't that be heaven on earth? Well, no, of course it wouldn't actually, would it? It would actually be unendurable purgatory on earth. That's what it would be. For much as we may complain about our daily work, much as we may have the right to complain because of the essentially alienating nature of much work in our capitalist economic system, which makes material prosperity the only reason for work, the fact is we need to work. The book of Genesis tells us Adam was placed in the Garden of Eden to work it, to take care of it. Work is a necessary part of our self-fulfillment as human beings. Maybe some of us have even discovered that in the last few days, in these languid hours of our Christmas break. It is idleness which is the real curse, isn't it? Not labor at all. Ask any of the unemployed scanning the lists at the job centre. They will tell you that. Monday mornings, then, should be happy occasions, shouldn't they? Occasions we anticipate with eager joy. If they're not, I suggest to you what we need is not deliverance from our work by some unexpected inheritance from Australia. Now, what we need is the redemption of our daily work. We need to understand work in a new way, a way that is centered not around material rewards, but around spiritual priorities. Jesus said, "Do not labor for the food that spoils, but labor rather," he said, "for the food that endures to eternal life." What should it profit a man, he said on another occasion, if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? Our problem for so many of us is that we are losing our soul in our daily work. It's precisely the recovery of our souls in our daily work that the Apostle Paul wants to help us in this study passage this morning. Paul's talking here, you see, in Ephesians 6, verses 5 to 9, about labor relations. Labor relations of a pretty extreme kind. He's giving advice to Christian slaves on how they should serve their masters. Now, if anybody had the right to feel trapped in their work, if there was ever a dehumanizing form of human labor, then Roman slavery was it. A Roman slave had no rights, no free time, no wages. A Roman slave could be bought, sold, beaten, and even slaughtered, like cattle. Yet the extraordinary thing is that where we might have expected Paul to advocate some quasi-Marxist revolution, or at the very least, some spirit of stoic resignation, faced with such an oppressive and exploitive condition as slavery was, on the contrary, what we find is the apostle instead encouraging a most positive and cooperative attitude. Obey your masters with respect and fear, he says. And not just in the fawning and obsequious fashion of a toady who wants to win the favour of his master whenever he's watching. No, you are to serve wholeheartedly, he says, with the sincerity which is born of a glad mind and a willing soul. That is actually the word he uses there, although it's not translated soul in our version. How can Paul possibly offer such advice? These are slaves he's addressing. One recalls Abraham Lincoln's famous comment. Whenever I hear someone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong desire, he said, to see it tried on him personally. Paul was lucky. He was a Roman freeman. Isn't he at least tacitly arguing for slavery here? He certainly gives no hint of any fundamental moral objection to it as an institution, does he? Marx, of course, said that Christianity was the opiate of the people, a political narcotic designed to keep the oppressed masses content with their miserable lot. And little wonder he came to such a conclusion if this craven advice from the Apostle Paul was anything to go by. Paul, it seems, would turn every Christian slave into some deferential and docile Uncle Tom. Or would he? I want to suggest to you this morning that, in fact, there are two great principles informing these verses in Ephesians 6, principles which apply not just to slaves in first century Roman society, but to every working man and woman in our modern 20th century society too. If we grasp these two principles, if we embrace them, then they will transform our whole attitude to employment. They will turn the most arduous bondage into a fulfilling career. They will turn the most tedious routine into an absorbing occupation. Most of all, they will turn the week around, so that instead of sighing with relief every Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock, there will be a spring in our step on Monday morning at 9 a.m. It can be so. What better way to start 1992, eh? Than with the resolution that 1992 will contain 52 happy Mondays, including, of course, bank holidays and vacations. Well, here are the two principles that can do it for you. The first is the principle of mutual service, and the second is the principle of divine vocation. Let's see how they inform what Paul has to say here. First of all, the principle of mutual service. Do you notice how often that word serve occurs in verses 7 and following? And do you notice the strange thing he says in verse 9? Serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. That last phrase is really a key to the passage as a whole, you know. Masters, treat your slaves in the same way. On the surface, it seems very odd, doesn't it? For here is Paul telling slaves to serve their masters well, which is okay, it makes sense, even if it is a bit grovelling, as we've already said. But then he says masters do the same to them. Well, a master's meant to serve their slaves, then. Is that what he's saying? In a kind of way, yes, he is, you see. That verse 9 proves that Paul is giving us here a third and a final illustration of the general principle which he in fact laid down right back in chapter 5, verse 21. Do you remember it? Submit to one another, he said, out of reverence for Christ. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Now, those of you who follow this series of studies in Ephesians will recall that Paul believes no human society can be happy unless the virtue of humility is much in evidence on all sides. This is because in society there have to be asymmetric relationships of various kinds. That is, relationships in which one party has the role to lead others and another party has the role to accept the leadership of others. Such asymmetric relationships are all around us. They in no way contradict the fundamental equality of us human beings. They are simply necessary to social organization. Society can't function without such authority structures. I mean, to give a simple example, when you go out on the street and you see the policeman directing traffic, you don't conclude to yourself, oh, he must be a better man than me because he's wearing the uniform. No, it is simply that in the role which he has to occupy, it is his job to give me directions. And it is my job to accept his directions. And if we don't play our roles properly, there is going to be an almighty mess up in the middle of the road junction. This is the same with life in general. There are all kinds of authority structures in society which have to be respected. But the reason our society disintegrates so often is that we lack the humility to make such authority structures work properly. So that those who lead abuse the privilege of power and exploit the weak. And those who are led resent their underprivileged status, as they see it, and rebel against the strong. And so what we find in so many situations of life is that oppression, on the one hand, and revolution, on the other, feed off one another and create a constant oscillation of rivalry, a swinging between authoritarianism and anarchy. Paul insists that only humility, the humility that as a principle of life submits to one another out of reverence for Christ, only that humility can put matters straight. And he insists Christians of all people should demonstrate that humility because Christ did. He, after all, was the one who humbled himself, as we've been thinking this Christmas time, though he possessed the right and authority of ruling the universe. He voluntarily abdicated his power and came amongst us as a baby. Came amongst us even more as a victim of oppression. He took the form of a slave, says the New Testament. I did not come to be served, but to serve. Well, says Paul, that being so, we Christians should know how to submit to one another out of reverence for this humble Christ. He has illustrated this principle, which he lays down in 5 verse 21, twice already, and we've looked at it in previous weeks. First in the context of husbands and wives, in chapter 5 verse 22 through to verse 33, and then in the context of parents and children, in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. In each case, Paul says here we have an asymmetric relationship in which one has the role to lead and the other to accept leadership, and this requires mutual humility. If that asymmetry is not to result in some kind of social dislocation. Well, now in chapter 6, verse 5 and following, he's supplying us with a third illustration of this same general principle of mutual service, mutual submission, mutual humility. But this time, it's in the context of the master and slave relationship. And that, if you think about it, is different from the other two. Different in this way. Family relationships, as we've argued in previous weeks, are God-ordained. They're part of the creation order. And for that reason, it doesn't matter which society you belong to, in all time and all over the world, it doesn't matter which society you belong to, there will always be families there. Husbands and wives bringing up their children. The authority structures that are built into those structures of marriage and kinship, they are designed by God. They are the way we are made. They're part of human nature. We can't escape them. But the master-slave relationship is not like that. The master-slave relationship is not God-ordained. Nowhere do you find in the Bible that the master-slave relationship is part of the creation order. On the contrary, it's an authority structure which we human beings have manufactured for ourselves. And that's why it's not universal, of course. It's perfectly possible to create a society without the institution of slavery in it. Indeed, it's desirable to do so. It's not a God-ordained authority structure, it's a man-made one. And yet, here's the perhaps rather unexpected point. Paul reckons that his general principle of submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ is just as relevant, just as applicable to such man-made authority structures as it is to those divinely designed authority structures which are intrinsic to family life that he's just been talking about. It's true God doesn't make us to be masters or slaves as part of his creation order, but that, he says, does not mean that Christians have the right to hold such social distinctions in contempt. Now, this, I fear, is where some radical Christians have misunderstood the New Testament. In particular, they've misunderstood the implications of a famous text in Galatians 3:28, where Paul says, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, you are all one in Christ Jesus." Paul is adamant that in Christ, social class discrimination is abolished. But we are not to draw the conclusion from that, that the New Testament supports, as it were, egalitarian anarchism. On the contrary, Paul tells us here that man-made authority structures, even socially undesirable ones like slavery, are to be respected by Christians. For society needs such structures if it's to function at all, and there is little harm, even in the worst of them, provided such structures are swamped with humility. Christian slave, he says, you must have the humility to treat your master with respect and obey him. Christian master, he says, you must have the humility to treat your slave with respect too, not bullying him. Both of you are to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ in this way. See, just as in the case of the husband and wife and the parent-child, there is an asymmetric relationship here. And Paul insists that the Christian response to such relationships is not to obstruct or resent the authority it represents. It is not to be abused or resented, this authority that it represents. Rather, he says, out of reverence for Christ, we are to make it work. The best it can, we are to make it work. By taking that attitude, of course, the sting of slavery's cruelty and inhumanity is completely drawn, isn't it? Instead of smouldering indignation or sullen insolence, the Christian slave, he says, is to serve wholeheartedly. Instead of contempt or physical intimidation, the Christian master is to treat his slaves with the same respect he expects of them. This principle of mutual service, he says, applies to all human relationships in which Christians are involved, uncongenial and unjust ones, no less than God-ordained and necessary ones. For Christians do not change the world by being Bolshe. They change the world as their master showed them, by accepting the role of a servant, even an abused and a suffering servant. Nowhere are the implications of this for slaves put more powerfully than in the first letter of Peter, where the apostle writes, "To this you were called. Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." And of course, in using that word called, Peter introduces the second principle which is informing these words in Ephesians 6. Not just the principle of mutual submission, mutual service, but the principle also of divine vocation. Look at those early verses again, from 5 to 7. And notice the explanatory phrases that Paul appends to every injunction. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ, he says. And again in verse 6, obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. And again in verse 7, serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not men. Because you know the Lord will reward everyone for whatever he does good, whether he is slave or free. Now, Paul, I suggest, is implying quite clearly here that the Christian is to see his or her daily labor as a sacred calling, in which they are accountable not just to a human boss, but to God himself. Now, frankly, that is a quite revolutionary idea. I don't believe anybody had ever expressed such an idea before. Of course, Old Testament prophets and priests were regarded as servants of God. They received a divine calling to their special profession, and they were sometimes anointed with oil during the appointment ceremony to indicate that. But nobody else in the Old Testament period saw their job as a vocation. Nobody else saw their job as, in any sense, sacred. Vocation was the prerogative of what we would call full-time workers for God. Your average doctor or lawyer or farmer or housewife would never have dared to aspire to such a noble title. And yet Paul is here implying that every Christian, even a Christian slave, is to see themselves as working for God in a full-time capacity every day of their lives. Every Christian's job is a divine vocation, he suggests. I say it is a revolutionary perspective. It invests work, humanly speaking, even degrading kinds of work, with a vertical dimension of immense significance. And it's because of that heavenly perspective of divine vocation that Paul is able to counsel these slaves to adopt such a contented and uncomplaining attitude. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ, he says. Obey them not to win their favor when there's eyes on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God. Not just their will, but the will of God from your heart. This is not then to say that Paul approves of slavery. As a Jew, he belonged to a people who had long memories of slavery, bitter memories of slavery. Never had they been allowed to forget that they had once been slaves in Egypt. And when God emancipated them from that slavery, he made it quite clear in his law that that kind of pagan slavery was never to be practiced among the Jewish people. That's what the Sabbath legislation was all about. According to the Jewish law, a Jewish domestic servant could not be held in service for longer than 6 years. They had to be given the opportunity for release in the seventh year, and with a generous gratuity to boot. What's more, the law laid down very strictly that every Jewish domestic servant had to be given one day off a week. They had to be free every Saturday. Remember the Sabbath, he said. In it you shall not do any work, nor your manservant or your maidservant within your gates. Why? You are to remember you were slaves in Egypt. There was no time off there. But there will be in Israel for everybody. There could be then no sweatshop mentality in Jewish homes. All this Rabbi Paul knew very well. Roman slavery was absolutely repugnant to the law of God. There was no way such an inhuman institution could be viewed with approval by a Christian conscience or even by a Jewish conscience. But the question is, how were Christian slaves to respond to their situation in the Roman Empire? Paul is not endorsing slavery here as an institution. He's not indifferent to the exploitation of man by man. He's not being blasé or complacent regarding issues of social justice. The struggles of William Wilberforce and Abraham Lincoln to see slavery abolished are not being opposed by Paul here. But he's not talking about the ethics of slavery as such. He's answering the question, what should a powerless Roman slave who becomes a Christian do about his situation? How should he respond to it? Should he foment rebellion? Well, of course, it had been tried. Spartacus and many others had done so, but it didn't work. It was just a ticket to even greater repression of the slaves. In any case, even should such a revolution succeed, the economic chaos that would have enveloped the Roman Empire as a result might well have made them wish they had failed. For freedom, as the newly democratized republics of the Soviet Union are discovering even today, doesn't automatically make you prosperous. Sometimes in the short term, freedom may plunge your whole society into poverty. The breakdown of slavery in the ancient world would certainly have had that effect. Now, Paul knew a far better way of changing the world than that. Jesus's way. But to adopt it, you had to have great confidence, great faith in God's providential control of your life. Paul spells out this confidence in God's providential control very clearly in 1 Corinthians 7. He writes there these words. Each one should retain the place in life that the Lord assigned to him and to which God has called him. Were you a slave when God called you to be a Christian? He asks. Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can gain your freedom, of course you should do so. But he who is a slave when God calls him is now the Lord's freedman. And similarly, he who is a free man when the Lord calls him is now Christ's slave. So let each man, as responsible to God, remain in the situation to which God has called him. Now it's exactly that principle, you see, of divine vocation that Paul is applying here in Ephesians 6. He's not approving of slavery, on the contrary. He insists that as far as the ultimate perspective of heaven and of eternity is concerned, the master-slave distinction is quite irrelevant. Verse 8, the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he's slave or free. It's going to make no difference in the judgment of God, he says, whether you're a slave or a free man. Rather, the point is, when you become a Christian, you're given a whole new identity, a classless identity. Whatever your status, humanly speaking, you are now to see yourself as what he says in verse 6, a slave of Christ. If you think about it, that of course generates a fundamental equality within the Christian community. It's an equality not posited on inherited privilege or social utility. It's an equality posited on our calling from God. Every one of us has such a vocation. And it's for that reason that Paul can say to slave owners in verse 9, you must treat your slaves very carefully. Don't threaten them. For there is a master in heaven, your master, as well as their master. He doesn't show favoritism. You're accountable to him. Similarly, it's for this reason that Paul can say to Christian slaves, be content with your situation. Obey your earthly masters. You're not to fret or fume about being a slave. It's not that important. But as a Christian, you have all the privilege, all the status you need. You are spiritually free. You are the slave of Christ. What's your reaction to that? Do you say, oh, that's all pious claptrap, that's all pie in the sky when you die? That's exactly what Marx meant when he said Christianity was the opiate of the people, telling people things like that. I assure you, it isn't so. You take on board this principle of divine vocation and you will find it is political dynamite. This principle of divine vocation has transformed the world socially far more effectively than Marxist revolution has ever done. For the fact is, of course, violent revolution doesn't achieve the political goals for which its advocates claim it. It doesn't deliver people from tyranny, does it? In 9 cases out of 10, it simply reinforces tyranny or substitutes a new tyranny for an old one. It doesn't establish justice in society. On the contrary, revolutionary violence brutalizes human beings, generating the most appalling barbarity on the streets of what were once civilized societies. Revolutionary violence does not liberate, it is enslaving in itself. Once it has gripped men's hearts, it takes centuries of re-education to break it. Jesus has shown us a better way. political dynamite, but of a slow-burning kind. The social change it produces may take longer than that of Marx, but it's also much, much less destructive, you see, for it is fueled not by a vengeful hostility, but by a reconciling love. The Christian slave can be, says Paul, a contented slave. For he's in no hurry to gain his liberty. He can be patient, free or not. He's proud of the divine vocation, the divine calling he has received. Each day he wakes and goes to his tasks in the knowledge that he is doing the will of God. Doing it from the heart. Let them call it the opium of the people if they must. But such an attitude, I assure you, will work social change more radical and more revolutionary than anything a left-wing fanatic has ever thought of. And it has done so. Jesus brought freedom to slaves, not by exterminating his oppressor, but by psychologically emancipating the oppressed. The revolution he worked was first and foremost not one in the political and economic arena, in the revolution of the structure of ancient society. The revolution he wrought was wrought in the slave's perception of himself. There is no greater battle to win. And I have to tell you this morning, it is the secret of the same transforming miracle on our Mondays, too. Oh, I know you and I are not slaves or slave owners, at least not in the ancient Roman sense. But we have work to do. And if we're honest, it sometimes feels like slavery. We resent it like slavery sometimes, because we have to do it. Maybe the job, which you have, is one in which you have to accept instruction from others and are accountable to others, as Roman slaves were. On the land, or in the factory, or at the office, or in the college, or the classroom, even in the home. Maybe, on the other hand, the job which you have involves you giving instruction to others, being responsible for others, as a Roman slave owner was. A manager, a foreman, an employer, a teacher, or a parent even. Most likely, I suppose, these days, our jobs at various times involve us both accepting and giving instructions. Both being responsible to others and taking responsibility for others. That's the way in which the chain of command tends to work in our modern kind of mobile society. Whether you get paid for this work you do or not is of no consequence. Roman slaves didn't get paid either. Whether you obtain any social status as a result of the work you do is of no consequence either. Roman slaves had no social status. All of us, though, whoever we are, have work to do. And the point the Bible wants to get across to you and me this morning is that that daily work which we have is God's gift to us. It is given to us in his providential care for us. It is our calling. No matter how exhausting it may be physically, no matter how draining it may sometimes be emotionally, no matter how demanding it may be intellectually, that work, therefore, ought to be work in which we rejoice. It ought to be an enterprise from which we gain immense satisfaction. It ought to be a task we undertake with great diligence and conscientiousness, because it is a divine vocation. Nothing will transform Monday mornings more than that realization. If it could turn a Roman slave from a servile wreck into a man of dignity and honor, it can transform your Monday morning. And wipe that sullen face. Sure, there are personal problems at work. rivalry between members of staff, disputes between labour and management. Such problems are inevitable in any human organisation, but don't despair about them. They can be diffused by the principle of mutual service. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. Stop asserting your own rights and start demonstrating a humble concern for the rights of others, and you'll be amazed how such an attitude has the power to dissolve the tension out of industrial relations. Sure, there are low-paid and undervalued jobs in this world. Jobs that people look down on. Jobs that we are ashamed to confess to. Jobs that we feel used in or feel socially insignificant in. Such feelings are inevitable in a world where people admire status symbols more readily than they admire stigmata. But don't despair. Even such jobs are dignified by this principle of divine vocation. So serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord Christ. For you are serving him. That's why the hymn puts it, the servant with this clause makes drudgery divine. You know that story I've often told of the three workmen on the building site. And a TV interviewer comes up to them to interview them. He asks the first man, "What are you doing?" "Oh," he says, "what does it look like?" "I'm breaking rock. That's all I'm doing." Comes up to the second man and says, "What are you doing?" "Oh," he says, "I'm earning money to pay off the mortgage. That's what I'm doing." He comes to the third man. He says, "And what are you doing?" He says, "I'm building a cathedral." Nothing will transform Monday morning more radically than the principle of divine vocation. Sure, there are plenty of people in the world with what the world would reckon to be better jobs than yours. But I have news for you. They aren't any better. They may earn more than you do. They may wear classier clothes and drive a company car, but if you're a Christian, you have been called to do the job you do by the King of Heaven. Be you a council dustman, be you an impoverished student, be you an unpaid domestic engineer, better known as a housewife. You may even be technically unemployed as far as the world is concerned. You still have a job to do. Responsible before God to use your skills, your time, and your energies to his glory. That's what you're on this world to do. So this week, go back to that work and do it gladly for him. I can't promise you health and wealth in 1992. But if you take on board these two great principles, the principle of mutual service and the principle of divine vocation, I do promise you a whole year of happy Mondays. Let's pray together.